On this edition of Audio Berkman,
the consequences of this legal battle over the next 5 to 10 years are at core whether we will be able to be productive human beings who live not in a utopian society, but one that is distinctly more respectful of human freedom and a more equal and just global society. That seems like a worthwhile battle to engage in.
Yochai Benkler, professor of law at Yale University, explores the effects of laws and other controls that regulate information production and exchange on the distribution of control over information flows, knowledge, and culture in the digital environment. I'm John Palfrey, clinical professor of law and executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Over the next hour, we'll hear Professor Benkler discuss these and other topics from his new book, The Wealth of Networks: How Social Production Transforms Markets and Freedom. The Wealth of Networks is a comprehensive social theory of the internet and the networked information economy. In it, Professor Benkler describes how patterns of information, knowledge, and cultural production are changing, and shows that the way information and knowledge are made available can either limit or enlarge the ways people can create and express themselves. Professor Lawrence Lessig of Stanford Law School has written about Yochai Benkler's book, The Wealth of Networks. He says, "This is by far the most important and powerful book written in the fields that matter most to me in the last 10 years. Read it," Professor Lessig says. "Understand it. You are not serious about these issues on either side of these debates unless you have read this book." Audio Berkman is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School.
And what I want to try to do in the next 30 minutes is give a very concise version of answers to two basic questions. The first, what can we say about the underlying economics that characterize the new practices and why we should understand them as stable, sustainable, basic, as opposed to a passing fad? And the second question that I'll spend most of my time on is, given the development of the practices that I will describe to you, and assuming that they are stable for the reasons that I will suggest to you that they are stable, what does that mean when we change the way we produce information, knowledge, and culture for core liberal commitments to autonomy, to democracy, and to social justice, with a particular emphasis in this case on global development and issues of information and development? So here's an image. Between 1835 and 1850, the cost of what it was understood as, of starting what was understood as a mass circulation paper in New York, rose from the equivalent of $10,000 in 2005 terms to the equivalent of $2.5 million. And the difference between $10,000 and $2.5 million is the difference between something that can be done for all sorts of reasons and something that needs a business model. And what happened over the course of the following 150 years was a stark bifurcation between producers who could amass the capital necessary to engage the professional effort to create enough copies to circulate to the relevantly expanding community, and passive consumers who received these end products and consumed them. We saw increased professionalization, increased commercialization. We saw two basic business models for amassing the capital necessary to engage in information, knowledge, and cultural production: the market and the state. And we saw this stabilizing and characterizing these areas of production for 150 years, from the mass circulation press through to radio, television, satellite, the mainframe, until today. Here's a different image. In the middle of 2002, a great fear fell upon the United States. For the first time, the world's fastest supercomputer was being produced in Japan, the NEC Earth Simulator. 2 years later, a collective sigh of relief can be heard in the supercomputing community. IBM GeneBlue had just inched out the NEC Earth Simulator, and dominance arrived back on the shores of the U.S. Throughout this period, everyone ignores the fact that out there, the SETI at Home project is generating far more computing cycles than any of these supercomputers. How? By creating a platform to allow on the order of 4.5 million people to share their leftover computer cycles when they weren't using their computer. They said, here, I'll download a little piece of problem, I'll calculate it, and I'll send you my result. What are we seeing? We're seeing, and this is the critical long-term shift, we're seeing a radical decentralization of the capitalization of information, knowledge, and cultural production. Storage, computation, and bandwidth are now widely distributed in the population. This is not lower capital intensity. The transition is not low capital intensity, high capital intensity, low capital intensity again. It's low capital intensity, high concentrated capital intensity, high decentralized capital intensity, which means roughly that every connected person on the planet, somewhere between 600 million and a billion people, depending on who you believe, has the physical capital necessary to make information, knowledge, and culture. Well, this puts us in an interesting new situation, because the most important inputs into the core economic activities of the most advanced economies are now widely distributed in the population. And these are the physical capabilities of computation and communications, and human creativity, intuition, experience, and motivation, which themselves are non-fungible and held by individuals. And any of you who think they are fungible, think back to the last time you made a transition in a job. Try to put on a piece of paper all your experience. Hand it to the next person and say, here, now you know everything I do. And you'll know that it's non-fungible. What happens when you make it feasible for individuals, both in terms of capital and human abilities, to engage in activities? Behaviors that used to be on the periphery of the economy, social relations, cooperation, friendship, decency, move from being outside the core of the production system and around it into its very core. We see two phenomena, or two connected phenomena, emerging from connected human minds and motivations. One is commons-based production, the other is peer production, or rather a subset is peer production. Commons-based production is production without exclusion from the inputs, from the outputs. It can be both individual and collective. It can be both commercial and non-commercial. The critical feature for purposes of what we will care about in terms of how innovation works, which I won't talk about here, but I do in the book, and for purposes of politics, which I will talk about here, is the fact that the information, knowledge, and cultural inputs, as well as the outputs, are kept free for everyone to use, both in a commercial model and in a non-commercial model through a commons. The second subset of commons-based production is large-scale collaborative production. And this has both pooling of human effort, motivation, creativity, and sharing of material resources like we saw in SETI at home. Peer production, large-scale cooperation among human contributors, the critical characteristic is without price signals or commands as the organizing principle. And what I won't talk about here, but I spend a chunk of time talking about in the book, sharing of material resources, like distributed computing in SETI at home. We also see it, or at least early versions of it, in wireless mesh networks for purpose of connectivity. We see it very well in distributed storage. P2P networks are distributed storage systems. There are other similar arrangements. And we see all sorts of mixtures, like Skype, where you get voice over IP by people sharing their storage, their communications capacity, and their processing to create a global voice network without any single piece of dedicated network, just what people, the resources people bring to connect. But let me talk for a moment about peer production. So imagine that in 1996 you were told two groups of people saw the web and understood that the core mission-critical project was to create a web server application that would respond to all of these millions of people who come to web servers. And one of them was Microsoft, understanding this to be the next stage. And the other was a group of people who said, well, we need a slightly better web server. Let's put something together. And then I told you that 10 years later, these two groups were still around. One of them had 20% of the market, the other 70%. And you would plausibly say, you mean to say these volunteers still have 20% of the market? And you'd be wrong, right? They're the ones who have the 70% of the market, right? They're the ones who've written the web server that Amazon runs on and responds to all your requests when you go and buy Wealth of Networks or other things. Now, this is a fact. It's not a fact from one day to the next. It's a 10-year fact during the entire period of growth of this period in one of the most mission-critical approaches. Everybody talks about GNU Linux operating system. But let's take a look at this. But I won't say anything else about free and open source software. The critical point to see is that free and open source software is hard to argue with because it is measurable, it is succeeding in the market, and you can't say it doesn't exist because it's there and it works. But the principle of organizing production is actually ubiquitous. So an example that just gives a sense of how it works in a measurable way is Mars ClickWorkers, which was a project that, that NASA ran on images from Mars. Instead of having full-time, instead of having the same full-time scientists who were before paid to convert the images into maps, they set it up on this kind of a small intuitive interface. They allowed users to click on the craters. This generated an image. 3, 5, 15 people looked at 2x2 inch. They generated a consensus estimate. They generated maps. After 6 months, they looked at it. 85,000 people had participated, generating results that were, quote, practically indistinguishable from those of a fully trained PhD. What do we see? You reorganize the production process. You put it out there for free. And it turns out in 5 minutes increment, instead of watching TV, people actually generate science. You take a problem of production, you embed it in a social system of communication, and you get outputs that are measurably different. It used to be that I need to say a lot about Wikipedia. Now I just say, well, take Wikipedia as an example. And the reason is because it's been so successful. Lots of anecdotes about there about how it fails. One study in a reasonably respectable site, in a reasonably respectable publication, Nature, actually tried to send it to scientists and say, what do you think? And they came back with a broad verdict that said they're both equally crappy, which is great, right? If you imagine that Wikipedia is equally crappy to Britannica as an encyclopedia, 40,000 people, no real technological constraints, anybody can come and edit, and it's not worse than Britannica, roughly. No, it's complete. There are arguments and quibbling about how good this study was. But as anecdotes go, this is a study. Yahoo's great first innovation. We'll have people look at sites, and then we'll create a human-edited directory, and we'll tell you what's good, and that's better than all those people running algorithms. This was the innovation 8 years ago. And this is what they still have for online journals. Open Directory Project, 60,000 volunteers. I care about this thing, so I will edit this directory portion. And this has now largely supplanted that aspect. It's not that Yahoo hasn't got interesting things to do elsewhere, but not this. What have we seen? And I spend obviously a lot more time in the book on this, but what have we seen? If you imagine that you look at transactional frameworks as falling on a line of decentralized and centralized and market-based and non-market-based, because of the cost constraints on collaboration, we used to have decentralized and centralized market-based systems, the price system and firms, and we used to have fairly traditional non-market systems, government and non-profits, producing significant economic goods. Now, we had a lot of social activity in decentralized systems, but production activity less so. What we're seeing now is the emergence of social sharing and exchange as a more significant economic phenomenon. Easily visible are new forms of competition, peer-to-peer software as for distribution of music to recording industry, free up and open source software to Microsoft, Wikipedia competing with the mainstream commercial encyclopedias, Skype competing with telecoms. We also see new business opportunities. So if we used to have a market in well-behaved appliances like TVs and CD players, we're seeing now much larger emphasis on production tools like PCs, handhelds, the way that wireless is working. If we used to have very bifurcated consumer infrastructure good markets, we're now seeing dual-use machines, soft infrastructure like Wi-Fi and Skype. Most critical for the purposes of what I want to say for the rest of this talk, we're seeing a shift from finished information and cultural goods like movies and music to platforms for self-expression and collaboration. GarageBand for bands to distribute themselves. Craigslist, Technorati for blogs. The whole movement, the whole buzz around Web 2.0 today is in some sense people trying to make money from understanding that there's a market out there in creating platforms and services for self-expression and for people actually doing things together and alone than otherwise. And the last one, we're seeing surfers, which is a really weird framework. So here are these companies who basically say, well, stuff will flow out of connected human beings, and we're so sure of this that we're going to contract with someone else and say, we will provide you this service, because people will, not only that, we'll invest back in this. We'll put patents in here, and we'll put people, and we'll pay them, because stuff will flow out of connected human beings. This sounds crazy until you look at IBM's revenues over the past few years. Now, these are the revenues of the largest patent holder in the United States, right? So green is revenues from royalties. Blue is revenue from Linux-related services. For now, all I want to say is that social production is a real fact, not a fad. It's the critical long-term shift caused by the Internet. In some contexts, it's more efficient than markets and firms. Even when we can't say discreetly that it's more efficient, it's certainly sustainable and growing fast. But it's a threat to and threatened by a whole series of incumbent business models that are built in the industrial information economy. What we see today in intellectual property and telecommunications and a variety of other new and funky laws is a battle over the institutional ecology in which these social practices develop. To what extent are conditions going to be easier or harder for the incumbent models or for these new emerging models based on the legal environment? And the third part of the book is very much devoted to both mapping this debate and identifying where it is that it matters. But what I want to do for the rest of, for the remaining 15 minutes or so, is talk about the politics, why we should care about the outcome of this political debate. And I want to do this by talking about three major core commitments in a wide range of liberal versions or flavors of liberal theory: autonomy, democracy, and justice and development. And I'll spend most of my time on democracy. For autonomy, it's a complicated question. The chapter itself goes into a variety of details that I won't go into here. The critical point I want to make is this. In the economic shift from consumers to users, what we see is a new practical capacity to act that wasn't there before, all constraints given, including legal and economic and technical. We see greater individual freedom to do more for and by ourselves, and perhaps more importantly, to do more in loose association with others, with the looseness here being critical because one of the constraints on collaborative action before was the necessity for long-standing commitments which limited the set of collaborations we could have, be it workplace, family, community. We now see much looser capabilities. Now, this has a whole... I spend a whole chapter on why this is good or bad given the fears of the breakdown of society, which I won't talk about here because I'm focused really on these liberal commitments. So just stories. 5 years ago, I took my now almost 10-year-old to see a Viking ship that came to South Street Seaport. And we came back home and we Googled Viking ships. And this came up first. It's still first 5 years later. It's a fantastic site with all sorts of children's materials appropriate for children of various levels. It's produced by a fifth grade teacher in Gander, Newfoundland, out of his schoolroom class. And if you imagine for a moment the range of possible things one could imagine for oneself to do, producing teaching materials globally alone from your fifth grade class was simply not there as an option, as a way of being. Now it is. Not only that, there are some things that you can't do by yourself. So Michael Hart for years was trying to create an online digitized library. It was only in the last decade, he's been working on this for 30 years, when you could actually get lots of people to scan, lots of people to cooperate in proofreading, etc., that he actually really, Project Gutenberg, succeeded in really taking off, and he has now been able to actually produce this thing that he's been dreaming of for a long time because of the possibility of finding people not who are employed in the same workplace and go to the same place, but who spend an hour or two a week doing this together. Now let me talk about democracy. The critical thing to remember here is that our experience with democracy in the public sphere, not in the theory, in the practice, is deeply embedded in the mass media culture. Other than the early American Republic, the early Dutch Republic, some aspects of British Parliament, and the French Republic for about 3 years, there is no real democratic country that doesn't post-date mass media, if we understand mass media as being somewhere around the middle of the 19th century. Certainly the ascendancy of democracy has been, in this century, heavily after radio and even more so recently television. So the first thing we need to begin to learn about is what does democracy look like when we introduce social production? Because we know the critiques of mass media quite significantly. So if there is an image that identifies the best case scenario of mass media and democracy, it's the Pentagon Papers, when suddenly the United States learns about the failings of the Vietnam years. So how does it work? Ellsberg brings the paper to the Times has the money to actually put reporters in a silent room to emphasize it, to learn it, then to publish it, it comes to the public, the government brings and cuts it forth with an injunction, they shift it over to a similar one like the Washington Post, the injunction moves over, they now have the money to go all the way to the Supreme Court pushes away the injunction, and we get the information in the public. This is the ideal case. What's going to happen in the public sphere? How does it work? I tell a bunch of stories in the relevant chapters, but let me tell you one of them here, which really captures. So Diebold is a maker of voting machines. As you may remember, in 2000, the United States had a bit of an issue with the quality of voting. And so in 2002, a new experiment happened, which was electronic voting machines. You would have imagined that this would have been central. But actually, there was almost no mass media coverage. The little bit that there was saying, well, people were a little worried about, quote, it's going okay, and, quote, we're getting a lot of help. The first quote going from the person selling the machines, the second from the person procuring them at the state level. And this was roughly the structure of all the news stories, or at least all 10 of them. Now, it's not their fault. It's really hard to do this. There's source code. It's proprietary. It's really difficult to figure out what these machines are doing. Well, let's look at the distributed public sphere. Bev Harris, one activist, comes across the source code on an FTP site. What does she do? She puts it on Black Box Voting, her own site, and also in Scoop in New Zealand. There's a real global constraint here. And then Scoop puts on these, which actually teaches us some interesting things. So the first thing is, we can now reveal the code. Here, look for yourself. Critical to what we're seeing on the web now is the emergence of a see-for-yourself culture. Not trust me, but here it is. And someone out there in the distributed community has enough competence to tell me whether to believe this or not. Second, we think they're going to try to shut it down. No, we're going to go hire a fancy lawyer to go to the Supreme Court, make copies, distribute it all over the place. Now, it's true that some of these things are password protected, but here are these nice people from lostpasswords.com. They'll really help us with that. And some of these things may be a little corrupted, but here are these nice people from Zip Repair who will give us another utility to help. Now, we don't have the money to pay anyone to actually analyze this really tough stuff, but, you know, it's really important. Good hunting. Let us know what you find out. This is a little bit like stuff we'll connect and I'll contract with you. But as it turns out, of course, one of these many people, Avi Rubin from Johns Hopkins and his research group, actually finds some issues with the source code. They get published. They're respectable enough that there's a Diebold response. There's peer review. There's media exposure. Maryland, one of the states considering these, then requires more studies, which then end up in required modifications. This is not the end of the story, because Bev Harris then becomes a node and somebody to email to expose things to. So when an anonymous whistleblower finds a cache of email materials from inside the firm, he, she, I don't know, sends to Wired and sends to Bev Harris. Wired writes a story that says, can you believe these people at Diebold? They lost their stuff again. And that's the end of it. What does Bev Harris do? Well, she knows what to do. Put it on Black Box Voting, everybody. But now Diebold has a different strategy. Now Diebold says, it's ours and you can't have it. Copyright. We bring an action. We'll sue you under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act if you don't take it off. Not Bev Harris, her ISP, her internet service provider. Well, the internet service provider takes it off, and that's the end of the story. No, because some Swarthmore students have already made copies, remember the recommendations, and they have it on. Well, Diebold already knows what to do, so they send another letter to Swarthmore, and Swarthmore indeed folds, and that's the end of the story. No. Because by that point, an entire ecology has taken these materials and begun to work with them. Individual users at other campuses and all sorts of other places. A combination of free and open source software, legal, commercial, non-legal. The emails get distributed over Freenet, which is a free software program that's censorship resistant and not music sharing. It also gets put on Overnet, which is created by eDonkey, which is a commercial firm trying to make money from people sharing music illegally, but also accessible by software that's free software that's intended to interface with this network as well. What we see is an ecology, as I said, of commercial and non-commercial, legal and illegal, creating a context in which it's impossible to suppress. But can you actually analyze it? Well, as it turns out, lots of people looking at lots of emails, somebody comes across something and sends it off to the California State Commission that's about to certify. It's very dramatic when you read the proceedings of the State Commission. It's almost like this Perry Mason, wait, I have this piece of paper here. And then they say, we can't make this decision. We're about to certify them today, but we're not sure. Another study, it turns out a large number of the machines were not the ones that were actually certified. A lot of machines are decertified. Now, law plays a role, right? The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, helps the students. They sue for declaratory relief so that it's not a copyright violation, so they get the freedom. And they win. They win so much that Diebold is forced to pay their attorney's fees because the judge basically says, this is so ridiculous. But they win 1 year later. Too late to affect the elections. But it wasn't too late because of the way the networked information environment worked. Now, the claim that the internet democratizes is older, practically speaking, than the internet. Because it was such a dream that the claim that everyone a pamphleteer and the internet democratizes is ubiquitous. And it's been subject to two generations of critique. The first generation, let's call it the Babel objection, there'll be fragmentation, the daily me, nobody will be able to talk to anybody else, there'll be no public sphere, there'll be polarization, Cass Sunstein's arguments, everybody just talks to people who believe like them, nobody will pay the watchdog, well, we already know that that will happen. Then there's a second generation critique coming out of literature in physics and computer science about how actual linking happens on the web that turns out a tiny number of sites are linked by thousands of sites, and millions of sites are linked to by no one, or so the image suggests, which suggests actually the problem is not fragmentation. The problem is simply replication of the mass media model. Still, everybody only sees Yahoo.com now instead of NBC, ABC, and CBS, but it's the same model. What sort of democracy is that? This is probably the most difficult part of the book, technically, so I will spare it to you. But actually, both of these, let's just remember one thing, two things. One, the claim always needs to be assessed not against the utopia of everyone a pamphleteer, but against the actuality everywhere of democracy in mass media. So the question is always, how much access is there given mass media? The second point is that the claims are empirical, first and foremost, about how people actually use. What we're actually seeing when we observe is that topics cluster, political blogs linked to political blogs, laundry detergent blogs linked to laundry detergent blogs. In the context of political blogs, when you go to small enough clusters of areas of interest, like specifically abortion or gun control or what have you, or within the Democratic public sphere, within the Republican public sphere, the things get small enough, it turns out there are tens, maybe even hundreds of moderately connected sites instead of no sites that are connected. And there are some sites that are wildly more connected. But these end up being not the broadcast stations to which we listen, but the broadcast towers through which this engaged community actually broadcasts across to larger images. There's an attention backbone that's being created. So no, not everyone a pamphleteer, but we're also not intellectual lemmings. The structured web creates a context where there are many entry points for many people, which are not so easily corruptible by money because there's no single core, which emphasize what's intensely interesting to these people in this community, because this is what they link to, and this then what rises up the attention backbone, instead of the classic problem of the mass media, that what gets on is what's sufficiently inoffensive to a large enough number of people. We see strong linking practices, a strong see-for-yourself culture, easier for each individual and small group to speak and behave and be heard, easier to form purposes of association, not utopia, but much better than we have now. And we see it being global and not local. The other now this is all about politics directly aimed at action. The other part is the emergence of a more critical culture. Anime movie videos, parodies, remix culture, and just to give a couple of examples. So what do we see? We see more plasticity, more malleability. What we're seeing is a reemergence of a new form of folk culture, more based on active participation than passive consumption. Now, it's actually tricky to map the role of culture in a liberal political theory, but the emphasis that I make is one on the way in which we can plausibly relate the actions of individuals to the way they frame their understanding of the world through the set of cultural conversations they participate in. And that mass media culture separated individuals from this set of symbols because of the commercial structure, because of the capitalization structure, and created habits of passive consumption, which now slowly we're beginning to see people overcoming and becoming again involved in creating their own stories and telling the stories about how their lives are and how their lives could be. The other thing we're seeing is as people write more into culture, culture is becoming more transparent. So just as an example, if you go to Microsoft Encarta, a very popular encyclopedia, this is the entry on Barbie. And this is all that it has to say, and this is the typical Barbie. If you go to Wikipedia, you actually get a lot more. In particular, you get a very explicit conversation about the gendered meaning of Barbie, the commercial meaning of Barbie. You see both arguments about why Barbie might be a good thing or a bad thing. You see a separate talk page where people say, should we do it this way? Should we do it that way? What are the implications of talking about, yes, the body image, not the body image? Culture becomes more transparent, not in the context of an academic conversation that we're all comfortable with, but out there available everywhere. And when you look at just the Columbia Encyclopedia, by the way, has Barbie Klaus. Google, on the other hand, if you look at Google, which is a distributed form of collecting relevance, you go to Barbie, you immediately get Barbie.com, but very quickly you have Adios Barbie, a body image site for everybody. If you go to Overture, which at the beginning was a serious competitor to Google, that had exactly the opposite way of thinking. You get ranked based on how much you pay Overture. Not you get ranked based on how much people on the net think you're worthwhile enough to link to. Trust me, you can go for a while before you get to the body image for every site. That is to say, when they've run out of people willing to pay. Now, let's end by talking about justice. In 3 minutes or less. You don't have to listen to me here. You can come to Yale next weekend. This weekend, actually, we've got about 90 speakers, 400 people from all over the world talking exactly about this set of problems. But the basic point is this. More of what makes human welfare and development depends on information, knowledge, and culture. If we just look at a very crude measure, the Human Development Index, health and life expectancy, education and literacy, and GDP per capita or growth. Food security depends on research to some extent. Medicines depend on research. Research in journals, outcomes data to know what we've done is right or wrong. When you talk about education, books and teaching materials, computation and communication, libraries, academic centers, growth and GDP per capita, we've known already for at least 50 years that the way we manage innovation is absolutely central. Each of these components and the way they feed into each other depends on how we produce information, how we manage our information, the degree to which they are accessible, both for production and for consumption. And if we have a genuinely new way of organizing production that doesn't displace all the market, but really works along it, do we have a new solution space? And I work in some detail trying to work on each of these industrial sectors. The answer, by the way, is not. Here's one theoretical answer for all of these. The answer is it depends on the particular production problem, it depends on the particular industrial structure, and I go to some extent why it is that free and open source software works so well and why it's a good, why adopting free and open source software is a good development strategy. Open academic publishing works very well. Much harder to do and very different even from each other is efforts at open source agricultural and biological innovation. Lots of farmers out there, lots of national agricultural research centers, lots of proprietary genomic data that makes it difficult, interesting new ways of working in biomedical innovation, bioinformatics, much more like software, much easier to do. Wet labs, much harder to do. I won't go through the details. I'll just give an excessively optimistic three images. One is, and trust me, in the chapter, it's all moderated 7 degrees. One, in the University of Cape Town, a bunch of graduate students work for 3 years, end up with a free high school science text available for South African schools and in the process of being approved by the government now and currently working on math and chemistry books as well. The International HapMap Project, efforts at genomics research and mapping haplotypes, purely run on an open source model, requires everyone to contribute back into the commons. BIOS, Biological Innovation for an Open Society, based in Australia, creating an enormous patent database in order to work our way through the patent lanes, but also something like a BioForge, modeled on SourceForge, the basic open source software development platform for purposes of pulling together innovation and beginning already to get buy-in from companies like BASF, not Monsanto that owns the core patents, but BASF that wants to participate in the research and beginning to look at the model that we're seeing today with IBM and HP and Red Hat playing together with the open source community. And if you want to get really utopian, here's Will Scott from Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis, idea, put together a set of kits that are intended to synthesize chemistry that's coming out of computational biology as potential targets for poor country diseases, for neglected diseases. And in order to get the actual synthesis, put together kits that you send out to 25 different institutions, and they're used in undergraduate chemistry classes. Instead of producing the thing that they would have produced anyway and then pour it in the garbage, they'll produce this that's actually usable. And if they do it in 25 places, maybe the redundancy will get the quality good enough that will actually work. As I said, very utopian still, other than you actually see stuff. Now, we're in the middle of a battle over the institutional ecology. I want to make only one point here instead of going into all of this. It's happening in broadband. It's happening in trusted systems, in the hardware. It's happening in software. It's happening in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the NET Act. Law and the state largely have been trying to push in favor of the incumbents to control all of this distributed stuff so that people continue tuning into their TV and buying the stuff that comes out of the system. But that doesn't mean they'll necessarily win. There's been enormous pushback from commercial purposes, from, if you just look at trusted systems and the idea of system, when people talk about trusted systems, not everybody is in the field here. So they talk about requirement that the machine won't do everything you want it to do. For example, it won't copy films. So it's trusted in the sense that the content provider, the video vendor, the music vendor, can trust the machine not to do what you, the owner of the machine, want it to do. But there are all these people selling machines out there. And I know I value a machine that works, not one that's crippled because somebody else needs it. So there's a real market tension there between these. There are also new social movements around free and open source software that are also working. In copyright, in contractual arrangements, we see a variety of rights in intellectual property pushing against this free sharing. I mean, just look at the things that I showed you. You'll see that there's one or two copyright issues. And yet at the same time, we're seeing increasingly strong social sharing practices. We're beginning to see social movements and actual legal efforts in the Creative Commons movement, the free culture movement. In particular, from my perspective, given our conference this weekend, we're beginning to see even at a global level the development of an A2K, an access to knowledge movement, pulling together developing countries, rich country consumer advocates, but also major players like IBM and Cisco who are concerned about excessive patents for their own business model, collaborating on trying to push back a little bit on this international system. So to wrap up, My core claim is that technological threshold conditions enable greater individual human agency. Because of this greater individual human agency, we're seeing social sharing and exchange emerging, not as the soul, not as supplanting the market, but as a major new modality, and this is critical, of economic production of information, knowledge, and culture. We're beginning to see and practice new ways of being free and equal human beings. But these practices are contested, and they are subject to a global and persistent political and regulatory battle. Now, the consequences, if one understands this as I describe it, the consequences of this legal battle over the next 5 to 10 years are at core about how we will continue, whether we will be able to be productive human beings who live not in a utopian society, but one that is distinctly more respectful of human freedom and a more equal and just global society. That seems like a worthwhile battle to engage in.
You've been listening to Yale Law School professor Yochai Benkler speaking on April 18th, 2006 at Harvard Law School. Audio Berkman is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, on the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu/audio. I'm John Palfrey, and thanks for listening.